it's not too late to save these orcas. I think some people hear, well, there's only 73 of them left. Is that too few? And I want to say, no, it's not. It's not too late for these orcas.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, anthrozoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is off. They're awesome.
Now, what do you think is the deal with animals?
As promised, the second part of the Pacific Northwest Wildlife Corridors miniseries will explore the waters of Puget Sound with Quiet Sound Program Director Rachel Aronson. Now, this episode was actually recorded before last week's episode, so you may hear some references to both of these episodes, which makes them seem in the opposite order. But you can, in fact, listen to either episode in whatever order you would like. So now that that's out of the way, the Quiet Sound Program is a project at the Washington Maritime Blue, an NGO that seeks to accelerate the sustainability and equity of the blue economy. Quiet Sound is a coalition of local, state, federal, and tribal governments, the maritime sector, and conservation NGOs. And if you love everything orca, then this is definitely an episode for you. Rachel and I are going to cover this important project, but also chit-chat about what makes orcas, and especially our southern resident orcas, such a cool member of the Pacific Northwest neighborhood. Rachel holds an MMA from the University of Washington School of Marine and Environmental Affairs, as well as a BA in Biology and Hispanic Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. But before we jump into the episode, I just want to give my shout out this week to Canada, because Canada's listeners make up more than 8% of the listeners of this podcast. And so I want to give you a shout out and a quick wave to the northern resident orcas as well. Thank you very much for coming. And why don't you introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Sure. Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here. My name is Rachel Aronson. I'm the director of the Quiet Sound Program at Washington Maritime Blue. My pronouns are she and her.
Thank you very much. Now, as we were just saying, there is so much going on right now in our area to do with wildlife and protection, and specifically your work regarding the southern resident killer whale. So why don't we just jump right in? What is the Quiet Sound Program?
Sure. Well, the Quiet Sound Program is Washington State's collaborative, non-regulatory program that seeks to better understand and then mitigate the impacts on southern resident killer whales from large commercial vessels. That's a lot of words to say that we help the shipping industry be safer and more sustainable around endangered orcas in Washington.
Okay. So how does your project do that?
That's a good question. I kind of like to begin by telling people about the history of orcas here in Washington. Humans have shared the waters of Washington with orcas since time immemorial, and orcas have been very important for the first peoples of Washington. When settlers came to Washington, orcas were a bit of a mystery. The first settlers in Washington didn't understand what orcas were. Were they a threat? Were they dangerous? How many of them were there? These people didn't really understand. So until fairly recently, you know, now from our current day perspective, we tend to think of orcas like the pandas of the sea. Until fairly recently, they were sort of seen as mysterious and dangerous. In fact, in the early days of orcas being captured for captivity, often the orcas were found with bullet holes because fishermen would shoot at them to scare them away from perceived competition for fish. And the sight of an orca would clear a swimming beach, kind of like Jaws, because people didn't understand what they were. We now know that they're not a threat to humans. In fact, we are much more of a threat to them. The wild capture industry in the 60s and 70s pulled a lot of our orcas out of the waters of Washington, which was bad and led to a lot of their status of being endangered today. But it was also an opportunity for scientists for the first time to start thinking, hey, we can identify individuals, we can identify families. So it was relatively recent that people understood that the southern resident killer whales are a specific group of whales that are related to each other. They do not breed or interact with the transient killer whales. And the southern resident killer whales, they have critical habitat from California up to Alaska, but they spend a lot of their time here in Washington. So we've kind of adopted them as our own particular whales.
So what is then the difference between the transient and the resident? Are they actually different species? Is one a subspecies?
That's a good question. Technically, they're the same species, mm-hmm. But it kind of depends on how you define a species. As far as we know, they don't breed with each other. So perhaps over time, they might diverge to be different species or be considered different species. But they have pretty different life histories. And one of the biggest differences, which kind of leads us in a very roundabout way back to Quiet Sound, is that the southern resident killer whales are fish-eating orcas. And the transient killer whales are mammal and bird and fish and everything-eating orcas.
Okay.
And they particularly love marine mammals. The southern residents use echolocation to find their food.
I've linked episode 48 in the show notes if you want to get more information about underwater bioacoustics. We talked with Dr. Michelle Fournette in that episode about underwater bioacoustics and discussed her work in this area at the beginning of the series.
So that's when they send out a squeak. They hear its echo in the water off, say, the flanks of a Chinook salmon. And then they say, ah, my prey is over there and I'm going to communicate with my pod and we're going to go get it. That means that they need what we call acoustic habitat in order to find their prey. So they need a nice big space where there's no anthropogenic or human-made noise at those frequencies that they use for hunting. And they need to be able to find those salmon, their preferred food. The transient killer whales don't use noise to hunt in that way. And since they're eating marine mammals, they have a very different food source. They, the transients, are doing pretty well, actually. We think their numbers are stable or possibly increasing. And the southern residents have been on a downward trend. Right now, there's only 73 of them left spread across three families, the J pod, K pod, and L pod. And their three main threats are prey availability, so the availability of those salmon in particular that they like to eat, although they do eat other fish. Toxins in the water, they're mammals, so the toxins flow into their milk, and then they pass them on to their babies. It's not great. And finally, physical and acoustic disturbance from vessels, which is where Quiet Sound comes in. So we know that a large ship underway radiates a lot of noise, and some of that noise is in the frequencies that the southern residents use to communicate and to echolocate. But we also know that ships can do different things to reduce their noise. And at Quiet Sound, we want to help ships do that in a way that is safe for maritime and for the people on board ships, but also safer for the whales.
Right. And will it also affect, I assume, the salmon themselves?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure anyone's done any research on noise effects on salmon, but there was a really recent paper from England where a PhD student showed that noise has a negative impact on crabs. Hmm. When ship noise are played at green crabs, the green crabs did not want to mate. Which was interesting. And there's some research from Puget Sound that shows that ship noise has a negative effect on eelgrass, of all things. Huh. Yeah. I like to think about noise in the water. It's much more of a full body experience than we as land mammals feel it. You know, we think about noise like, oh, it just hits our ear and then it's gone. If you're an orca in the water, noise is a full body vibration that you experience. And noise is a much more, sound is a much more important sense for them than it is for us. Light doesn't get you very far when you're underwater. So sound is the easiest way to tell, hey, my pod's swimming over there. There's a undersea bump over here. There's something approaching over there. So we really want to protect their acoustic habitat.
When there's a lot of sound in the water, then I imagine it's very disorienting. Can they just not, I'm going to use quotes here, see as far ahead of themselves? So their environment sort of comes in, you know, it shrinks. Is it even more than that? Is it completely disorienting?
Yeah. It depends on how loud and how close and how often. The same way humans can develop hearing loss over a period of years. Marine mammals can also develop hearing loss. Yeah. But we know one of the fabulous things about noise pollution, such as it is that unlike toxic pollution, when you stop the noise pollution, it's gone. As opposed to, you know, like a factory that's putting lead in the water. Even if they stop putting lead in the water, the lead will linger in the ecosystem for a long time. Noise pollution, once you stop the noise pollution, voila, you've got some great habitat. So one of the things that we've been looking at in Quiet Sound is how can we help mariners understand their proximity to whales so that they're making reductions in their ship noise at times when whales are present to reap the benefits. So Puget Sound, for folks who have maybe never looked at a map of Washington State, is a fairly narrow waterway in the interior Salish Sea. And there are a lot of places where the whales are sharing that habitat with very, very large commercial vessels, like tankers, bulkers, cargo ships, car carriers, all the giant ocean-traversing ships that make our modern life possible. We know that a ship's noise, at least its underwater noise, largely comes from the propeller. It's sort of fascinating when, you know, your typical screw-shaped propeller turns, it sets off little air bubbles in the water, and these tiny little air bubbles are created and then collapse. And that creation and collapsing is called cavitation. And that's actually the largest noise impact from the ship, from these teeny, teeny little bubbles.
Wow.
Yeah, but quite a lot of them. And a fascinating thing is that when a ship slows down, most ships with sort of traditional ship structures, they can reduce their noise quite a lot, even up to 50%, which gives us an opportunity here in Washington to say, hey, there's an orca nearby. If it's safe to do so, can you slow down your ship, add maybe an hour of travel time to your route, but you're reducing the noise pollution around the orcas by 50%?
All right. So the Quiet Sound program then is a voluntary program where do these ships sign up for this to receive the information? And then who's giving them that information?
Yeah. Well, Quiet Sound came to be about a year and a half ago when the Washington State Governor's Orca Task Force said, hey, we want to look around and see what kinds of things are people doing in other places to protect orcas that we're not doing yet here in Washington. And one of the programs they looked at was the ECHO program in Canada, which has a similar voluntary vessel slowdown plan. Quiet Sound is a coalition of state agencies, federal agency, tribal governments, the maritime industry, and conservation NGOs who all come together to say jointly, let's make some recommendations to ships. So it's a voluntary program in part because of the interesting nature of our collaborative structure. We can make voluntary recommendations a lot faster than regulations can be signed into law. So we can move more quickly. But also because we really want to recognize that vessel safety is paramount. Puget Sound, luckily, knocking on wood here, we have not had a large oil spill here in Puget Sound. And we want vessel pilots and shipmasters to understand that we don't want them to do anything that would endanger their ship or potentially cause a crash or a spill in pursuit of slower speeds around the winds. Mm-hmm. So that's part of why it's voluntary, that we tell the ship pilot and the shipmaster, you have all the leeway here. Please make your safe choice first and then slow down if you can. We work with several scientists, advisors, mariners to put together a proposal for the vessel slowdown. So it takes place in piloted waters of Puget Sound, meaning there's a professional pilot on board who's based in this region and gets on board the cargo ship as it arrives from Asia or wherever it came from. Mm-hmm. And that pilot can say to the shipmaster, hello, we have a slowdown going on for the orcas. It's based on the season when they tend to be here, and we validated it with current sightings. And here's some recommendations for how we should proceed with our speed. And this, we started planning it about a year and a half ago, and the current slowdown started October 24th of 2022. And right now, as we speak today, it's January 5th, 2023, and it will end January 12th.
Okay. So, okay, a couple of questions.
Yeah.
First of all, who provides the sightings? Is that your group specifically, or is it other ships that have seen them, and then they sort of, maybe there's an app that allows people to check in?
There actually is an app. My hat tip, first of all, to Washington-based sightings networks like Orca Network, Puget Sound Orcas, other groups. There is a large, robust group of orca fans here in Washington, and it's members of the public who provide these orca sightings. The sightings flow into an app called the Whale Report Alert System. It's mm-hmm. developed by the Canadian nonprofit Oceanwise. And the Whale Report Alert System sends fresh whale sightings out to verified commercial mariners. So it's kind of like Waze for whales. If you're a mariner, you can have it on your phone and you'll get a buzz saying, hey, there's a whale within 10 nautical miles of you. You open it up and there's a little dot on the map where the sighting was located. It tells you what species, what direction of travel, how many individuals. So it's a useful real-time tool in addition to the seasonal time delineated slowdown recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's it been going? How do you track whether this has helped?
We're collecting several lines of evidence for this first trial of the slowdown. So the first one is AIS data. That stands for Automatic Information System. It's a very bland acronym, but what it is this very neat system whereby ships over a certain size are mandated to have a transponder on board that sends out information about what ship they are, what's their heading, what's their speed, what's their location. And we work with a partner called the Marine Exchange of Puget Sound that actually has a network of receivers high up on mountains over Puget Sound and the Strait of Juan de Fuca that collect data from these transponders. Hmm. So we gather all that ship speed data, hand it over to our scientist, and his team tells us, hey, we took the ship speeds and a tidal model, and we can tell you which ships reduce their speed to the target goal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we get a big list of ships and which ones participated and which ones didn't. We also are working with the Puget Sound pilots to collect information on pilot reported participation. So that's when a pilot finishes their journey, they check a box saying, this ship participated, this one didn't, and maybe they put in a little information about why.
Okay.
Interestingly, so far, the pilot reported participation is significantly higher than the participation through AIS.
Interesting.
We don't know why yet. We think it might be that our tidal model, it's just a model predicting the tides. Mm-hmm. The tides in this area can actually swing pretty large in each direction. Mm. And we're wondering if it's because the model in its predictions is not as good as a human who's on the ship.
Yeah.
Not sure. Figuring that one out. Scientific mystery. The other way we are tracking participation and the impacts of this slowdown is through a hydrophone. This is an underwater microphone. It's about 1,000 pounds, and it's a lander. It looks kind of like, think about something that NASA would drop on the moon, but it's a big base that we drop on the seafloor. And it has a battery system, a buoy system, a recorder, and then two little microphones, and it records ship noise. And we'll use the timestamps of that recording plus the AIS data to say, hey, when this particular ship ran over the microphone, this was its speed. This is what it sounded like. Mm. So we'll get a measurement at the end of the trial of how much we actually reduced noise.
Okay.
Yeah.
And will you see that reduction? How will you see if that reduction directly impacts the whales? Is this... we're going to see more births next year or healthier looking whales? What are we looking for?
Yeah, that's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. There's so many different factors that affect the ability of these whales to thrive. Mm-hmm. Our hope is that we'll end up with a metric of how much we reduce noise when whales were physically there. And it's possible that over time we'll be able to develop a model of, for a certain amount of reduction of noise, this is how many more fish the orcas had an opportunity to get.
Interesting. Okay. Yep. And we know from past research that noise is an issue. So that's not really up for debate. That's not really what you guys are looking at. We already know that it's an issue. So any kind of reduction is going to increase their quality of life, if nothing else.
That's true. Yeah. The science of noise impacting orcas is pretty solved.
Yeah.
We just need to see if over the times we create these quieter areas, do orcas spend more time there? That's a possibility.
Mm, that's a good, metric.
They have been very present this year, which has been pretty exciting.
Yeah, I really noticed that. I feel like I'm hearing a lot more about the orcas in the, in the news, in the media, in general. There's a lot more sightings going on, and that's kind of a nice change from, 2 years ago, before this project started and before the task force was even created, which I'm assuming that the task force was created partially in response to that tragic set of circumstances where one of the mother orcas carried her baby around who had died and carried it around on her rostrum, we call mm-hmm. it, right? Mm-hmm. For like 6 days. That seemed to get a lot of media time pretty much across the world, and really seem to galvanize at least our area in this idea that, oh, wait, if we don't do something to help our neighbors, the orcas, then we're not going to have them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, the task force was set up a couple months before that orca lost her baby.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Which I think speaks to both the governor's foresight and the importance of the orca here in Washington. Mm. But you're absolutely right that that orca, some people called her Telequa. Mm-hmm. Telequa's tour of grief really galvanized, I think, all of us here in Washington into looking at what more can we do for these whales. And so it's really exciting to be at a place where we can make recommendations and the maritime industry says, yes, let's do it. We've had very good participation rates for this first voluntary slowdown. One question I get a lot is, well, you know, isn't Maritime mad at you for telling them to do all these things? And I say, no, they were at the table from the very beginning of Quiet Sound, because they were just as motivated as anyone else here in Washington to do what they can for these whales.
I was wondering, whale watching is such a huge industry here. Are they participating? Is that part of how we get sightings? Are they part of the slowdown? I mean, there have always been rules, haven't there, around whale watching ships maintaining certain distances and turning off their motors and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whale watching ships are managed by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So they are under their own set of regulations and the voluntary proposals don't apply to them.
So they don't have to participate, or they're just not really included in it?
They're already regulated in a different way.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't need voluntary proposals. They're pretty regulated. I'm making like a little box with my hands for podcast listeners here. So whale watchers are off under their own set of regulations.
Okay.
Before Quiet Sound, cargo ships did not have any regulations around whales. So having the voluntary proposals in place is better than the previous. And I think we're in a good place for our first year. So right now, our first month of participation, 61% of ships participated in the slowdown. Mm-hmm. According to AIS, it was 70% through pilot reported participation. So it's somewhere in that 60 to 70%
range. It's not a huge difference.
No, it's not. It's not huge. As a scientist, I get bothered by it, but we'll figure it out. But it's a really great place to be, actually, because our Canadian counterparts in their first year of voluntary slowdowns, which was 2017, they had 61% participation. And now they're in year six and they have 93% participation.
Nice.
So I think we're in a really promising spot for our first year. And I'm hoping several years down the road, we'll see similar 90% plus participation rates.
So originally, this wasn't supposed to go out to January 12th. Why did that change? Why did you guys extend the period?
Mm-hmm. The original end date was December 24th, and we decided to extend the period because our hydrophone was slow to get in the water. Mm. It was our group's first time working with permitting agencies on the permitting for a hydrophone, and it just took so much longer than we thought it would. I think about 9 different government agencies had to sign off on some aspect of the planning for this hydrophone. So rest assured, our hydrophone is exceedingly safe. Mm-hmm. We appreciate that in-depth review from all permitting agencies. And next year, we'll just start many more months in advance. So we went out to pilots, tribes, shippers, and the Coast Guard and said, hey, does anyone object if we extend this slowdown 2 more weeks just to make sure we get enough data in our hydrophone? Okay. And everyone said, sure, that's fine. And I'm so glad we did, actually, because even 2 days ago, the Superpod, which is what we call it when J, K, and L of the Southern residents are together, was present here in the slowdown waters. So I'm so glad the slowdown's still going, because it means we've continued to protect their acoustic habitat while they're here to enjoy it.
Yeah. And when that happens, when they kind of get together, are they interrelated as well? So they're their own family pods, but I imagine for genetic diversity, they probably interbreed amongst each other if they're not breeding with transients.
That's right. Superpods are a great time for them to engage socially and genetically with each other. They live in matrilineal groups, so the babies follow their mothers, but they've got to get the fathers from somewhere. So yeah, superpods are a great time for them to exchange DNA.
And I'm just interested in orcas at this point. So do the male, are there male pods and female pods, or are there some males that hang out within the matrilineal pods? Or are they more solitary?
Yeah. So my understanding is that the males will hang out with their mom.
Okay. Just their whole life.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Like my brother.
As a mom of a boy, I'm like, yeah, this is great.
Yeah, right. That's great. Yeah.
But we know that those older females play a really key role in steering the pods. And orcas can live a very, very long time. Their lifespan is somewhat equivalent to a human's. So those, I like seeing the matriarchs yeah. swimming amongst them, leading the way.
Yeah. And they're one of the very few animals, I believe, that, essentially live past their breeding age, right? So the females, after they can no longer breed, I assume they go through a version of menopause, they continue on. They don't just sort of die out the way a lot of species do.
Yeah. I think that orcas are one of the animals that, you know, as humans, I think we're often so limited in the way we understand and perceive animals. But orcas, they have a culture just like us, which is fascinating. And we can see them do things that we know don't really have a direct connection to survival. And we can identify that as play, as experimentation. And there's something that across the species that really speaks to us. Like one year, there was a fad amongst the southern residents for wearing salmon on their heads.
What? Yeah. Okay, I need a picture.
We don't even find a picture. Have any idea why, but apparently they'd catch a salmon and they'd just flip it onto their head and swim around for a little bit with a salmon on their head. Huh. And...
okay, so if you want to see this phenomenon, I did the work for you. Just take a look at my Twitter feed and you will see a link to an orca wearing a fish as a hat. Oh yeah, my Twitter handle is The Deal With Animals Podcast.
You know, they just thought it was the cool thing to do.
It's some sort of orca joke?
Orca joke, yeah. It's a fascinating thing to witness.
Yeah, that's really funny. So what do we know about... you said there's a certain amount of time that the orcas spend in this area. Mm-hmm. What is that typical time?
Yeah, so they tend to be in fall and winter. They tend to come down into Puget Sound looking for those salmon runs that are returning to the rivers around the same time. Then they spring, they tend to go out a little more out into the open ocean coastal waters. And then summer, they're kind of up in the San Juan Islands. So they have a little bit of a migratory cycle, and they're following specific salmon runs for the most part. Yeah.
So when the salmon are running, that's where they're going to be.
Pretty much. Yeah. My dream, if there's any PhDs out there, I would love to see a predictive model for orca presence that's based on salmon runs.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to work on that, let me know.
That sounds very interesting.
We do know, just sort of at a high level, particular runs tend to have a predictive effect for the orcas. So here in Puget Sound, we have an every other year chum run. Chum is a type of salmon. Mm-hmm. And the orcas will come in a lot for that particular chum run. And then years when that chum run is not running, there's fewer orcas around.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, and I assume as our waterways get healthier and we're able to promote more salmon coming back and then salmon running, we're going to hopefully see more orcas in our area as well.
That's the dream. Yeah. Washington is doing a lot of great work on salmon recovery. Mm-hmm. And we're restoring salmon runs, taking barriers out of waterways.
So very early on in this podcast, episode 8, I had a great conversation with Dan Hintz of the Greenway Trust about his work on salmon habitat restoration. So if you want to hear more about that, I'll link that in the show notes. So very early on in this podcast, episode 8, I had a great conversation with Dan Hintz of the Greenway Trust about his work on salmon habitat restoration. So if you want to hear more about that, I'll link it in the show notes. It was a fun episode. I may or may not have had a glass of wine.
There's still a staggering amount of old dam infrastructure that has no purpose. It doesn't generate power. It's just a wall in a river just sitting there. And taking all those types of things out over time, we hope helps the salmon and helps the orcas.
Yeah, it sounds like there's so much we could be doing that would not, you know, damage anyone's livelihood, would not change how we're getting energy. It would just be cleaning things up and making things run smoother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Washington here, we saw the Elwha Dam removed a couple years ago. This was a defunct power generating dam out on the Olympic Peninsula that was removed. And then a whole ecosystem basically came back where there had been a dammed up river. Suddenly there was a complex river ecosystem with little gnarled bits of fingers of water under vegetation and all the types of things that fish like. A whole sand spit was created from the sediment that came out, which is a great habitat for crustaceans. So anyway, thinking critically about, you know, where did we put some concrete in a river that we don't need anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of work to be done there.
And where can we continue to preserve what's working so that we don't make any more mistakes in terms of blocking things up too? Mm-hmm. This particular episode is sort of going to go hand in hand with our next episode, which is related to the Save Coal Creek project, where we're going to be talking about a particular area that is part of salmon habitat and necessary for that. And when we start thinking about how the interior habitats affect the sound and are the exterior habitats from the land, you know, they're one and the same, right? They're connected and it's all going to affect each other. So I can only imagine that the Quiet Sound Project is going to have a positive benefit, as we talked about earlier, maybe on the salmon too, and hopefully help with their rehabilitation in our area.
Yes, I hope so. I know that I've got some fabulous colleagues over in the salmon recovery side of things, and we'll just keep chugging away in the water.
Yeah.
And hopefully all hands can help lift the orcas up.
Yeah, definitely. I almost feel like the sound itself is the culmination of a wildlife corridor. You know, there's the wild, we talk about a lot of wildlife corridors on land where animals can move around, but it's rarely sort of extended into the waterways, at least from what I have heard. And it feels like the waterways are part of that wildlife corridor.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes salmon so fascinating is that because of their migratory life, they go from the forest out into the ocean and then back and bring those nutrients all the way up to the trees of the forest again. They tie the whole ecosystem together and this richness of the ecosystem supports the apex predators like the orcas and like us. So in a lot of ways, the things that make an ecosystem better for orcas are also better for humans.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So are there any myths that you would want to debunk from what people think about orcas, know about orcas, or even about the project that you're working on?
That's a good question. I think one thing that I'd like to underscore for folks is that it's not too late to save these orcas. I think some people hear, well, there's only 73 of them left. Is that too few? And I want to say, no, it's not. It's not too late for these orcas. Both scientifically, there's a pretty good body of evidence that genetically they're not at a bottleneck, that they're still producing genetically diverse babies, that they have enough variance in the population to continue to survive. But also for us, we have not yet done all the things we could be doing for them. And now's the time to really push it forward and keep going.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking too about the importance of these particular orcas because they are possibly, I suppose, a subspecies of our transient orcas. Although, as you were saying before, it's not really, they choose not to interbreed perhaps. But why is it important to save these particular orcas when other orca populations seem to be doing pretty well?
I think it all comes back to culture. These orcas have a culture that is unique in the world. Although there are some orcas in every ocean of the world, some of those populations doing great, some less so. Nowhere else do the orcas have this connection, this place-based connection like our orcas. Their level of understanding of the salmon runs, of the geography, the funny things they do with each other, their relationships with each other, it can't be replicated. And plus, there's nothing as amazing as seeing 73 orcas swimming together. I love the transient orcas, but they tend to gather in groups of like 3 to 5. And man, when you get the chance to see a superpod and you just look as far south as you can see and it's orcas, and you look as far north as you can see and it's orcas, it's just an incredible experience.
Amazing.
There's also not that many urban orcas out there. Mm-hmm. And so we have a really rare chance here in Puget Sound to show that humans and orcas can coexist.
Well, now that you've mentioned it, now I want to be out there. I want to go see the superpod. Can people do that? Is that safe for the orcas, for people to go whale watching at the moment when they're out there?
Well, there are so many fabulous opportunities to watch the orcas from land. So one of the fabulous things about Puget Sound being so narrow is that if you're on the shore and you have a decent idea where the orcas are, you can see them. I encourage folks to look up organizations like Orca Network and the Whale Trail that both help facilitate spottings from shore. Whale Scout is another one that helps people find orcas. They send volunteers out to neighborhoods where orcas are visible to help people find them. So there's a lot of great ways to do that. Even just yesterday, one of my friends posted a picture of the orcas that he spotted from our state ferry system. So taking the ferries is a great economically viable way to see orcas.
Yeah, that is so great because, yeah, we think we have to go out in the water, but we don't really. Sometimes you can get a really nice view from San Juan's or and lots of places along the peninsula.
Yeah, yeah. Even here in Seattle, I see them. Not all the time, but I've seen them a bunch this winter, which has been very special and cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Rachel, if there was a book that you could gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
One of my favorite introductions to orcas is a book called Orca by Jason Colby. And he focuses on settlers' first experiences with orcas when they came to Washington, and then really dives into the live capture era. Not going to lie, it's hard and heartbreaking to read it, but Jason was able to convince a gentleman who was in some ways the leader of the capture era to sit with him and speak with him for the book. So it's interesting. I think he makes the case that the captures helped people understand who these orcas were in a brand new way, but also doesn't shy away from the impacts that the capture era had on their modern day population. So it's a really fascinating book.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to recommend two books?
Sure.
Well, if you have a younger human in your life, or really anyone who appreciates good illustrations, there's a book called Springer by Donna Sandstrom, which is actually about a northern resident calf who got lost here in Puget Sound and was repatriated with her family. So it's an optimistic story, but it's a great introduction to the many humans, private citizens, government agencies, tribal governments, all the folks who came together to help this one real life orca.
Great. Thank you so much. I'll have to pick that one up for my daughters. That sounds good. Oh, would you share a early or first childhood memory of your connection with animals?
I've always been an ocean kid. I had the fortune that my parents took me to the beach in New Jersey a lot when I was a kid. And I always thought, yep, this is where I like to be. This makes me happy. I was interning with the Marine Mammal Stranding Network in New Jersey in high school and college. And but it wasn't until I moved out to Seattle that I realized, holy cow, New Jersey's coastline is not very healthy. And it was the Pacific Northwest that really taught me what it was like to see a thriving ocean ecosystem with less armored shorelines, more direct forest-ocean connections. But New Jersey will always have its slightly polluted place in my heart as the place that taught me all about horseshoe crabs and hermit crabs and dolphins and all the Atlantic animals.
What was the first animal you helped rescue?
Ooh, probably a harbor seal. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you about my first necropsy, which was a necropsy is a dissection. It's like an autopsy for an animal. And so this was a deceased whale. It was so deceased, we couldn't really tell what species it was. But it was either a fin whale or a minke. So it was huge. And it was so big that the dumpsters we were using to put pieces of it in were... this gentleman had used his dumpsters to help haul away debris from September 11th. They were building size dumpsters and the whale chunks would not fit in any smaller receptacle.
Wow.
Extremely stinky, but pretty amazing to see a whale heart up close and personal.
Wow.
Yeah.
What happens to all of that meat?
Landfill? Yeah. I don't know. But
I mean, it's better than blowing it up, which was, you know,
we know
anybody's ever seen that video. I'll have to link that one in the show notes because.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I did. That was not the best thought out idea ever.
We had a near catastrophe with this one where they tried to winch it up into the dumpster using chains and a crane. And the whale was so heavy that the chains actually broke and the whale fell down and. Splooshed. It was unfortunate. My apologies to anyone who was listening. I also got to dissect the first many-toothed blackfish that was ever found in New Jersey.
Oh, interesting.
That's a relative of an orca. It's a very rare orca type in the Atlantic.
I'm going to have to look that one up, too. I don't think I've seen one of those before.
Yeah. Blackfish is also one of the things that people call orcas.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Exciting. Okay. So maybe you can answer this question. What's the deal with animals?
I think there's something deep in our brains that responds to animals. When the southern residents are nearby, it's like a rock star or the queen has arrived because people will just line the shore and you see 20 to 100 people with their spotting scopes and cameras and binoculars all fixated on just a hint of fin. And you hear the gasps of the crowd when there's a particularly good breach and oohs and ahs and people sharing tips. It's like going to a rock concert. There are people out there who would probably tell you that spotting orcas in the wild, it's better than drugs. It's amazing. And there's something deep in your brain that just thrills to that experience. Mm-hmm. So selfishly, I think animals make us feel more alive.
Yeah, I can feel that too. nothing makes me happier than seeing a new animal behavior that I haven't seen before, particularly in the wild, you know, or even spotting one that I know about that I haven't seen before, which was cool. I remember the first time I saw crows mobbing a bald eagle, and it was like, ah, look what's happening. You know, it's the best.
Yeah, it really is. The first time I ever got to go, well, it's the only time I've been to the continent of Africa one time, and it was the most amazing experience because every animal was new to me. Mm. And so things that, you know, people who live there, like, it's like if you saw a squirrel here and you're like, yeah, it's a squirrel, whatever, you know, like, yeah. Oh yeah, it's a hedgehog, whatever. But I was like, did you see that hedgehog? My God.
Yes.
There's nothing stopping me from feeling that way about the animals at home in my own habitat.
It's true. I never really paid much attention to the birds in the Pacific Northwest until I traveled and lived other places and realized how cool some of the other birds were. And none of the people in the area, you know, were all that impressed by their own birds. And I thought to myself, I wonder if it's the same where I grew up. Like, maybe my birds are pretty cool too, and I just didn't really notice. So when I finally came back, yeah, I actually took a look around and pretty impressed by the birds here too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. There's something to be said for treating your own home like a tourist.
Yeah.
And getting really excited about the plants and animals that are around you.
Yeah, because those of us that grew up with orcas, you know, orcas have always been part of the culture here and you know, the art and the music and everything about orcas is really ingrained in the Pacific Northwest. So you mm-hmm. having not grown up with that specific sort of icon must have been a really fun experience to come over here and really see orcas for the first time here.
Yeah, definitely. And along those lines, I've been really privileged to work with members of tribes here in Washington because tribes have cultural links to these animals that go back since the dawn of time. And that's been, I feel like it's a real privilege to work on animal conservation in partnership with tribal governments.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today about your program. And I hope to follow up with you maybe in the future to find out how things are progressing.
I'd love that. And if any of your listeners want to catch up with us, we're at www.quietsound.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Rachel Aronson, Quiet Sound Program Director. You can find out more details at maritimeblue.org. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com and leave me a message. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. I'm your host, Marika Bell. I'd like to thank Kai Stranskoff for the theme music and Natasha Matsark for help with editing. You can see links to guest book recommendations, as well as their websites and affiliated organizations, in the show notes and at thedealwithanimals.com. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals? What do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network.